December 1st, 2021 to order. Starting off with roll call for Nevada's president, Marie.
Present.
Michelle Gertz.
Present.
Matthew.
Present.
Sue.
Here.
Justin.
Yep.
Michelle Maynard.
Here.
Josh.
Here.
And Charlie.
Here.
And Sandra's not official on our list, correct?
Correct. And technically, Justin is no longer on.
I was going to ask that question, too.
Yes. He's attending as the Clean Water Division Manager.
I still say that I'm here.
both present, but not a... Okay, great. Any public comments?
No. Do you want to do introductions for Sandra as well as for our guest speaker, Tanya Settles?
I do. I actually, I hadn't read down the list in front to see if there's anything, so let's just go ahead and take time to do that as well. So, Sandra, I know you and I have had a chance to meet, but why don't you go ahead and take a minute to introduce to the rest of the board?
Good evening, everyone. My name is Sandra Martin-Bame, and I am a longtime resident of Clark County. I was actually born in Clark County, and I currently live in rural Ridgefield, just south of the new Rourke, home of the Raptors. So I'm thrilled to be joining the group and thrilled to learn more about what the Clean Water Commission does for Clark County and how I can contribute to that.
Great. Happy to have you on board.
And you have a lot of background in transportation, correct, Sandra?
That's correct. I am currently the Director of Business Intelligence and Project Management for C-Trans. And I've been there just about 4 years.
Well, it'd be great having your background on the boards. One of the things we really appreciate is the diverse professional and educational background of all the members. And so it'd be nice having somebody with a lot of insight in that sector. And then, Alice, you said we have another guest.
We do. We have Tanya Settles from Kaleidoscope Group, correct?
That is correct.
Do you want to do introductions for the rest of the commission so that Sandra knows who everybody is? And so, same with Tanya? Or do you want to just...
Did you want me to have Tanya? Tanya, if you want to introduce yourself real quick, and then you're going to have some speaking time, and then I'll have the board do a run around and their own introductions as well.
That would be great. Hi, everyone. My name is Tanya Settles. I'm a strategic alliance partner and executive consultant with the Kaleidoscope Group. And the Kaleidoscope Group is actually a DEI consultancy firm. We're based in Chicago. I actually live southwest of Denver and have lots and lots of family in Clark County. So when I got the invitation, I was excited to have the opportunity to come and talk with you tonight.
Great. Thank you very much. We're looking forward to that presentation today. And thank you, Alice, for helping coordinate that.
You're welcome.
All right. So for both of your sakes, I'll go through the board introductions here. Everybody can take a little minute to introduce themselves. And I'll interrupt you in on that part too, Justin, since you're still going to be involved. But I'll start for myself, for the Natus chair of the Clean Water Commission currently. I'm not sure how many years it's been now. It's kind of scary how quickly that goes by, but it's been a couple that I've been with the commission. Sandra, you're coming on board at a really good point. I think over the last few years, we've done a really good job of trying to organize the group to have a little bit of kind of cohesion and guidelines, our mission and vision statements, and it helps kind of maintain the momentum. I think when I first started, and some of the other veterans can attest to this, it really kind of would lose pace every time we were changing personnel. And so I think the new layout helps a lot for new members coming on board and kind of keeps the whole operation going down the track there, making some progress. Myself, I live out in Washougal, in the Washougal watershed. I have a background largely in environmental restoration work, so a lot of on-the-ground projects. But if you overheard my conversation there with Matt, I recently started working for the Clark Conservation District as a project coordinator for them. So a lot more time behind the desk, but same subject material. I will pass it over to Marie to introduce herself.
Hi, I'm Marie Lamana. I've been with the commission since 2015 and have been chair a couple times and vice chair now. My background is forestry, business, and wastewater. Currently working for the wastewater district. And I enjoy doing the public outreach and educating the public on clean water and the good environment stewardship.
Michelle Gertz.
Hi, and welcome to the commission. I have been on the commission since about 2017, I believe, and primarily have led the partnerships working group. My background, I worked for CH2M Hill consulting firm for almost 30 years, developing the technology of wetlands for water treatment, storm water, and various other water sources, also cleanup of contaminants in soils. I live in the Salmon Creek watershed, and I continue to work on various wetlands restoration projects. Also have been doing field work in archaeology and paleontology. Somehow it always seems to wrap back around the wetlands. Thanks.
Thanks, Michelle. Matt, do you want to take a second to introduce yourself more?
Sure, absolutely. Thank you. Welcome, Sandra, and welcome, Tanya. And full disclosure to everybody, I know Tanya from other D-Links. But Sandra, I'm also a resident of rural Ridgefield. Been here 20 years. I'm on the other side of the freeway, though, closer to the east fork of the Lewis River, although the city of Ridgefield has incorporated just pretty much everything around me. The boundary now runs down the middle of the street, but I'm still technically a county resident. But originally from Jacksonville, Oregon, grew up down there. What I do is I'm a consultant, work for myself, do public sector consulting. Before that, spent some time doing various things, but right before that, spent about 8 years in the university as a faculty member of public administration and taught statistics, of all things. So that's it for me, I think.
Thanks, Matt. Sue?
Hi, thanks. I'm Sue Marshall, and we have our fourth generation now family farm in Ridgefield. We're at the corner of 41st and 169th Bowers Corner Farm. Just planted hazelnuts 3 years ago. They're in their third year. But my background, I have a degree in environmental health, and I spent most of, pretty much all of my professional career in Oregon, focused mostly on water as director of Tualatin River Keepers, and then moved into public policy issues as a contract lobbyist for a number of environmental organizations. So I'm in my third year with the commission, and I'm also serve as an elected member of the Clark Conservation District, and I'm a board member of Friends of Clark County.
Thank you, Sue. Michelle Maynard.
Hi, so I'm Michelle. This is my third year on the commission in Lackamas Creek watershed. When I first started my career, I was an environmental engineer, and I was cleaning up Superfund sites in California, doing groundwater, soil, air, everything. And then when we moved up to Washington, I switched to a civil position, and now I actually do a lot of stormwater modeling across the country for treatment and detention and all that good stuff. I'm licensed as a civil engineer in California and Washington, and yeah, we had Connor on the first, so as he knows. But yeah, so that's me.
Thanks, Michelle. Josh.
Hi, I'm Josh Seeds. I've been on the Clean Water Commission since I think 2017, and I currently work for Oregon, the state of Oregon, the Department of Environmental Quality. I work on drinking water protection and non-point source pollution, especially forestry issues. So I'm involved there in a number of projects, from scientific research up to policy and working with state legislators to protect drinking water sources and reduce pollution. Prior to that, I've worked in both laboratory and field ecology science. And I live in the southeast corner of Clark County in the Gibbons Creek drainage, which goes into the Columbia River east of the Washougal River. And the lowest part of Gibbons Creek is currently part of the Steigerwald Wildlife Refuge Reconnection and Restoration Project that I believe Brendan's former company had a role in doing plantings there. So that's coming along really nicely. It's a really cool way of putting wetlands back connected to the river and serving some other public goods at the same time.
Thanks, Josh. And yes, if they paid more to plant trees, I'd probably still be doing that. Charlie, go ahead and take a second.
Good evening. I'm Charlie Tomasi. I think I'm the newest member until Sandra came on board here, will be coming on board here. Started here at the beginning of this year and have not actually met everyone in person, but hopefully someday, fingers crossed, that will happen. My background is I went to law school and studied environmental law particularly towards land use planning and development and stuff like that. But I am now, through just kind of the magic of life, I'm now a school vice principal, and so I work in education and don't get to do this sort of stuff as a regular job like some of you guys get to do. But I live in kind of on the edge of East Vancouver and Camas, so I'm just kind of right there on that Lacamas watershed area. And pleasure to meet you virtually.
And I wanted to take a second to loop back to Justin. Justin recently moved from being a board member to helping coordinate on the county's end, so I'll let you elaborate on that one, Justin.
Yep, I'm Justin. I met Michelle doing our master's degrees at Stanford. She was in the environmental engineering program. I was in environmental fluid mechanics, so I was more hydrology and water resources. After that, I've had the good fortune to do so many things in water resources engineering, from storm drain master planning, floodplain modeling, statistical analysis on dams, wave run-up on levees. It's probably too much stuff to list. Pump stations, and then we moved here. I worked for PBS Engineering for a while, doing stormwater design, water system design, floodplain modeling, things like that for transportation and development projects, primarily. And my son is trying to introduce himself now. Alice, you're gonna have to yell at him soon.
Okay.
And I've done some stream restoration and bank stabilization work as well for a company called Waterways Consulting. We did a lot of our own surveying work that had me in chest waders out in the Willamette River. Yeah, I was just telling somebody earlier that one of my waders sprung a leak and I had a wet leg for 2 days on that project. And most recently, I moved from being a board member to, I'm as of July 20th, it's been a whirlwind 6 weeks, the Clean Water Division Manager with the county. So, as soon as I took that job, I couldn't be a commissioner anymore. Only a few months left anyway. Michelle mentioned it's almost been 3 years, and we moved here in 2018. So, I think I touched on everything. Well, yeah, you already mentioned Blackness Group. So.
Well, thanks for still being around in some capacity there, Justin.
Hey, I'm happy to continue participating. I'm glad to be here, and it's a great group of people, Sandra.
Well, thank you, everybody. Moving, as you mentioned, we didn't have any other public comments in.
No, I checked it throughout the day, and I checked at 6 o'clock, and there still was nothing, either email or voicemail coming in to the Clean Water Department. So.
Okay. All right. Well, then next on my list is another great introduction for our normal participation and those active in the community on water resource work, Clean Water Division Outreach with Eric.
Okay, thanks. Nice to virtually meet you, Sandra. I'm Eric Lambert, the Outreach Specialist with the Clark County Public Works Clean Water Division. I typically give an update on outreach stuff because this is a pretty active group in that regard. And so I'll just cover kind of what I've been working on the past couple months. Well, we had a student video contest this year for students, and we wanted to recognize those students by showing the winning videos, and so we did that at one of the City of Vancouver Movies in the Park nights, and we did that on August 6th at Washington Elementary School, and I thought it went really well. It was cool to show the videos and kind of get the message out and to recognize the students at the same time, and having the movie Wonder Woman 1984 kind of help give a boost, I think, to the student videos, because it seemed like they might have been the best movie that was played that evening. So that was a lot of fun to do that and to recognize those students. We've been working on a pet waste behavior change program pretty much most of this year, actually. And so we've done outreach along Cougar Creek Trail, which is a little trail along one of Salmon Creek's tributaries. We've done 4 outreach kind of tabling events since the beginning of July. And we've also been doing poop counts to kind of measure the effectiveness of that. And haven't seen a whole lot of variation from the amount that we're finding thus far. We'll do another one in September to see if any. If you have any more improvement in that regard, and kind of continuing to evaluate the program and see what's working and kind of what's not. One thing that's not, we had placed some trail signs, some signs along the trail with some messaging. Those signs were kind of disappearing, and at this point, none of them remain. So, you know, I'm chalking that up to you know, neighbors that really just wanted to share that message from their own yard. Maybe. Who knows? But that doesn't seem like that. That was kind of one of the aspects of that that campaign that we did kind of question for that reason. At least we have that confirmed. And we've been working on another big project, our private stormwater facility maintenance resources, where we're developing a suite of maintenance resources, including kind of printed handouts, videos, virtual tours, and training. And so we had a stormwater partners work group meeting, was that last week, and kind of got some final input on a lot of the printed materials. I'm now incorporating that final input and hoping to get this stuff sent off to the printer, hopefully next week, And we also discussed the trainings. We're hoping to do that in person, but we're looking like that might have to move to virtual, most likely. And we wanted to do that in the beginning of October, so we're exploring some other options there, whether we want to YouTube live stream it. We want it to be a little different than just a webinar that you might attend. We'd like to have that kind of interactive feel, and live streaming would allow it to be recorded and watched in the future, and also facilitate that that interaction between, you know, people that want to, contractors and landscapers who want to learn about what the maintenance standards are and how to do this type of work, both to better serve their customers and potentially even to kind of expand some of the offerings that their business could offer. But we also want to be able to have a few different representatives from different jurisdictions around Clark County, because there are some nuances in the maintenance standards from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So we're kind of putting that part together too. Everything will be coming together in the beginning of by the beginning of October to have the materials ready for the whatever type of training that we have. It's nice to go to see the finish line there. We're planning a Stormwater Partners Symposium, which is another kind of topic that we had on the Stormwater Partners Work Group, and we're looking at the second week of November for that. I don't want to say a firm date right now, but it's likely going to be in the second week of November. And likely to follow a similar type of format where we hear from some different groups about some of the projects that they've been working on this year. A big goal of that symposium is to connect some of the different groups that are kind of working in the same arena to understand where partnerships could be forged, where people are putting their efforts so that we can reduce the redundancy or the duplication of efforts, and really just to help people get on the same page and even make some introductions, because there's always, people changing in different positions, so it's nice to keep them connected. And that's one of the important things that our partner symposium tries to achieve. So, I can't promise that we would pick a topic. We haven't decided the topics yet, but I would open that up to if you guys have ideas for topics that you think would be suitable. I know that a number of you have attended the symposiums in the past. I'd be all ears to hear that, and then kind of bring it to the Stormwater Partner Work Group and see if some of those would be ones that would be a good fit. We're kind of excited about the Student Watershed Monitoring Network this year. Kind of students getting back into school. Just excited about that kind of starting again. Some other things we've been working on. The conservation districts have their PoopSmart grant, so they've got a number of grants. Working with the Watershed Alliance on a PoopSmart campaign for East Fork Lewis River and countywide. From an outreach capacity, I want to be there to support their efforts and to kind of be a sounding board so that they can come to me for support or feedback on any of the things that they're working on. I think it's in really good hands between the Conservation District and the Watershed Alliance. The county has more, at least Public Works Clean Water has a more defined role in the monitoring section of that project, and Public Health, of course, has their role carved out with overseeing the county septic systems and the on-site sewage system program there. Looking forward to continuing to work with those folks. There's definitely a tie with the Canines Clean Water program there. And so we'll we'll be in discussions about how we can, you know, incorporate our programs and really just synergize our efforts. And then finally, the last update, you know, the Clean Rivers Coalition, I'm on the steering committee for that, and we've been working on some different elements of an EPA grant that they got for the Lower Columbia, targeting pesticide use. And so I've been on a committee to help work with the contractors designing a website for that program with the campaign Follow the Water is the name of the campaign. The subtitle would be Connect the Drops. So it's neat working on that. And also they're developing some videos, two types of videos. First is kind of like a more of an emotive connection to the Columbia River type of video. And then another one will be some actual kind of pesticide use videos, or rather alternatives to pesticides type of videos that will help instruct homeowners, you know, what to reach for instead of that bottle of herbicide. So looking forward to those materials. And then on July 16th, which is also part of that, because you know, inclusion is a big is really a focal point in that Clean Rivers Coalition group. And so that part of that grant included a focus group for the Latinx community. And on the 16th of July, Laura Media, who had conducted that focus group, gave a presentation to what they've been doing. And I'll know more. I have a meeting with them, with the Clean Rivers Coalition Steering Committee, tomorrow, and I'm sure that we will be discussing their symposium, which will be coming up. And I think that they may incorporate Laura Media to give a presentation during their symposium or forum, I think they might call it. And so if they do that, you know, I can always invite any of you that might be interested to attend. They're a very open and inclusive group, you know, so much so to even recognize you know, how closely Southwest Washington is intertwined with Oregon as a state to invite us onto their steering committee and really, just being very cognizant of you know, the role that we play in the Lower Columbia and partnering in office. So that's pretty much what I have for my update. But I might actually stick around a little bit, but because I like some of the things in the agenda here. Does anyone have any questions for me?
It's always such a short list of what you're working on, Eric.
Try to trim it up before I come on here.
I'll just throw out there that Alice and Eric do a pretty great job letting you guys know what goes on at the division. But it's hard to actually appreciate just how much goes on in this division.
Yeah.
If you're not in it, because the second I walked through the door, and like I said, Alice and Eric, you guys do a great job telling the commission this, but there's no way you could possibly understand just how much this division does with the people that are in it. It's amazing.
You mentioned the Food Smart campaign coming on, and you're probably familiar with some of the data on this, Eric, and what's going on with it, but I'll just add anecdotally that a lot of what the district and the other organizations are going to be focused on, as you mentioned, is being able to help a lot with mitigations from livestock and septic inputs. That's really where the grant is designed to channel towards. Well, we ended up looking through some of that preliminary data that shows a pretty overwhelming amount of the DNA shows canine signatures. Bring it up in the meetings, like, well, I see that we have all these resources lined up for these other parts, but who's addressing the canine? And it's kind of like, well, that's Eric's gig. And I'm like, oh, no pressure.
Yeah, Eric, I can tell you as somebody here starting in a couple of days, I'll spend a good amount of my time in the wee hours of the morning along the Lewis River, and there's a lot of obvious canine leaving behinds.
Yeah.
So you have to be careful where you step in the dock. So if that, Brendan, their data doesn't surprise me.
No, we're going to see what we can do to channel more of the focus back to that. I'm familiar with a lot of the updates that Eric has given us over the past year, and it was interesting digging into more of it too, and doing that. So definitely an unfortunately impressive part of it. Eric, I did want to ask you, with the presentation they're going to be doing on the herbicide mitigation, is it the pesticide, you know, kind of can envelop multiple things? You're talking about the alternatives for herbicides. Are they also doing alternatives for insecticides? I know there's often been issues with the runoff of that and its effect on macroinvertebrates and thus salmonids.
Yeah, I think right now, that's a good question. I think they're kind of broadly saying it's pesticide reduction, and so I know that word kind of becomes a coverall. So, I don't know how much they're going to be doing on the kind of the true pesticide or insecticide rather versus herbicide. But I think that some of the stuff will try to incorporate that as well.
I'd be interested with that. I know from years of having done targeted herbicide application towards invasive species, there was lots of times where we were having to educate ourselves and having to often explain it to concerned members of the public about the science, at least as it's printed, on the herbicide effects on other organisms. And, you know, the idea being that a lot of them have been engineered to not have effects on X, Y, and Z outside of their target area. But with the insecticides, they're geared directly towards killing different insects and marketed to folks to be able to sprinkle it around their house if they want it, if they got a problem with something. And then the rain comes and washes that out. I know I had a colleague that had done his whole master's on that, the impacts on it. So I'd be interested if that incorporated too. I know it's I don't think quantity-wise that's the bigger issue, but I think acute effect is kind of the higher one.
Yeah, I think you could be onto something there. I'll be sure to bring that up in the meeting tomorrow and try to be able to report back to you guys on the next meeting here.
Any other questions for Eric from anybody?
I just say nice work, Eric.
Thank you, Sue.
As always, thank you, Eric. Alice, before we go too far, I recognize that there wasn't a review of minutes, but I'm from our last meeting, but I'm also not seeing them, at least in the materials I have. Did I miss that?
No, I accidentally realized as we were going through and I went, they didn't do the minutes, and I went, that's because I didn't give them. So I'm so sorry. Well, we will actually, we will approve the special minutes at the special meeting in October. How's that?
That sounds good. Well, we can move right into the staff liaison report, first topic being that special session meeting.
That's right. First of all, Justin, as Clean Water Manager, is there anything you would like to say? I'll yield the floor.
Nothing in particular. I mean, Jeff, the infrastructure crew had some projects that they were working on, one of which just finished up. It was an outfall up at Whipple Creek that the embankment just started sloughing off. So they realigned a pipe there. That project just got finished up for the most part, aside from plantings. Speaking of plantings, Brendan. which will be done later. So that is a clean water project that is just getting finished up. There's a watershed planning effort in the Mill Creek drainage area that's kind of an ongoing modeling effort under Rod for NPDES permit compliance for this permit term. That's been some relatively cool modeling. Rod talked to me a bit about his effort to create criteria to pinpoint which drainage basins to look at as viable areas for doing one of these basin plans under the permit. And that one stuck out because of the data availability and all of that. So they're building a calibrated model based on all of the data that's available on that basin. It's a pretty neat modeling effort. So those are just couple of highlights that stick out in my head from my 6 weeks around the division up to now. I guess I didn't really mention earlier that I've been at Clean Water for 6 weeks. Connor here is a month old, and he decided to come a week early while we're up at Mount Vernon. So it's been a bit of a whirlwind. that's all I can think of off the top of my head. I'm just getting caught up on things. I mentioned a few minutes ago that everything that this division accomplishes is pretty incredible, and it speaks volumes that when I walked through the door, Jeff and everybody had a 7 or 8 page Word doc with all the ongoing projects and status on all of them. So I think that speaks volumes in itself. It's a great group of people.
And that was single spaced, by the way.
It was completely single spaced, yes.
In like 8 font. Or what?
And then actually the other thing that's starting up really is the urban streams monitoring, which is kind of another one of the newer permit requirements that we're dealing with. That it's a very, very complex set of monitoring requirements that these guys are dealing with, and ecology trains them on it and everything. It's intensive. I think Chad talked to us a little bit about it when he was part of the commission, but they're starting that this year in earnest. So,
well, congratulations again, Justin. It's nice to have an official mole.
Hey, likewise on the congratulations. If I didn't say it when we met about the food smart.
Sorry. Yeah. Thank you. Sorry, Alice.
No, that's all right. So, I wanted to, first off, we have our next special meeting, which is slated for the first Wednesday in October, so October 6th, be normal time, 6:30 to whatever, 8:30 or so. I have Henry Schottenkirk right now signed up. He's going to talk a lot about the mapping and GIS and what he does. He's kind of the backbone of the whole GIS mapping for clean water, because a lot of it, if it's not mapped, it doesn't exist, and all of our requirements are based on what's mapped, and there are very stringent rules about what needs to be mapped in certain time frames. And so we have brought Julie on. I think she started about the week that the pandemic hit, and so she's had a number of issues we've had some challenges in getting her trained, being remote and all that, so that's been kind of an interesting aspect with it. So just to remind you, if you have any other suggestions, let me know. I'm looking right now at a couple different options, so if there's something that just jumps out at you that you would really, really like to know, I'm going to see if all of a sudden I lost her name. Devin is available. See if she's available to come in and talk about her new project now that the East Fork, the Lewis River, has finished. So we'll kind of see how things go with that. And if not, I'll find some other, I've got some other aspects. Potentially also code compliance. Yes, Michelle Gertz.
Any possibility on Lacamas Lake question? We talked about that in the source water.
Right. I'm going to look and see what I can do. There's a potential. Yeah. There's a potential on that. Is there a particular focus? Or because there's a lot of different groups that I could talk to about getting to come speak, is there something that you in particular are looking at or like to... more information on?
Brenda?
I was just going to say, if you were just mentioning having Devin
speak. I do believe Devin might have a lot to elaborate on that. From basically the Poop Smart campaign that's kicking off on the East Fork is a similar one moving towards Lackamas, and there's a committee separate from that grant project that is meeting, that's made up of community members, all focused on the whole, just all around mitigation of nutrient overload causing the blueness in the lake.
And I know
so
we have
know
a lot of interest in general in water quality, mm-hmm. and what can be done from neighborhoods around the lake, and it seems to have become a focus in the last year. We had some questions, I believe, in the last work session with the council about it, and so I thought that there were probably some activities going on in clean water and through other partners that the commission would be interested in hearing about.
Okay. I will.
I know the city of Kansas has been trying to put together some different teams to look at it as well. So I can't elaborate in detail, but it's definitely come to my attention that there's multiple groups and folks with concern paying attention to it. I would be interested myself in seeing more that is talking, as Michelle mentioned, the neighborhoods, because I know at least the work I've been getting to be involved in is, again, you know, grants are easier to target towards. Okay, here's livestock, here's septic, here's particular things we can go after, but the accumulative effect of backyards and individuals is a lot harder to, outside of outreach and education, it's kind of harder to go after, so.
Opportunity for partnerships. Oh, sorry.
No, yeah.
Okay. To promote partnerships across both political and also profit, nonprofit, and so forth. Boundaries to move things forward, Clark County, Plaquemines, Camas, and so forth. So, yeah. There's a lot of source area, and there's a lot of activity up there in the watershed that probably is affecting water quality in the lake. So,
okay.
And water supply, water source, period, water volume to the lake.
I would just like to add and second having Devin come and talk about both Lackamas and I think Burnt Bridge was another focal point, and the watershed planning that she is doing is an alternative to meet the TMDL requirements that identify the specific pollutants of concern. So I think that provides the overarching what needs to happen to improve this water quality, and then the neighborhoods and everything else kind of fit into that. There's a role for everybody to play.
Okay. I know at one time she was not. I know at one time Devin was not able to when I had initially had reached out. I will see if her availability is such that she is back working, and I think she is, and she's available to take on some of that and can do it. So I will see if I can get her. Josh, go ahead. Sorry.
I would be interested in hearing more on what the county's role is in cases of water bodies, like specifically Lackamas Lake and the Lackamas Creek watershed. There's a lot of different jurisdictions in play, so I'd be very interested to hear what specifically the county's role and responsibilities are, in particular with that TMDL and in general. And then I would definitely be interested in hearing from Department of Ecology about what the source assessment for Lackamas Lake says, and like what the where they've identified polluters and sources of pollution, particularly nutrients like phosphorus.
Okay. Great. I will look into that. I know Commissioner Michelle Gertz, you had asked about seeing if we could do a field trip this fall and know at this time, especially with Delta taking off. We are definitely not able to be in the position to do that this fall. Hope springs eternal for the spring. I'll continue to work on that and hopefully get something in place. We had even brought that up of potentially, you know, doing individual and small groups, but just with the staff and everything else that was taking place, it was unfortunately not going to work. As with the bylaws, reminder, I need for the three commissioners, or anybody actually, that will not be continuing on, or your term ends, so that would be Sue, Sandra, welcome, and also Michelle Maynard. Your terms are up at the end of this year, and I need to know by the end of September if that's something that you would like to continue or not, or you can go from there. Please, what we've done in the past is just write a letter to everybody and let us know. I should say, write me a letter. Actually, I think we've had it addressed to the commission, to the clean water manager, and usually it comes via me, saying whether or not you want to still continue to be on the board or not. And the sooner the better, because when we do open it up, we do have to have it open for 30 days, and I would really like to try and have the process done and wrapped up earlier rather than later, because it always seems to be the holiday season and Christmas. I don't know if they'll end up having a meeting on the December 21st or not, so I would like to sure have everything wrapped up before before Thanksgiving, and try to get everybody approved and on before the meetings in January. So if you could let me know, and if there's anybody else that is not able to meet their commitments of, you know, the 75% attendance, please let us know with that as well. As you know, there's been a lot going on with Public Works. Ahmad Khamenei is no longer our Public Works Director. We have Eva Haney, who is our Finance Director. She is now the Interim Public Works Director. And Rob Klug is our PE. There has been so much personnel and managerial change, especially out at ops. I'm not even going to run through the list, but there's a lot going on, as well as some at wastewater in addition. So there's been a lot of change going on, a lot of new people, some people are leaving, definitely a lot going on there, a lot of challenges. And even in clean water, we've had a couple staff who are off currently, and of course this is the busy time of year with monitoring. We have one of our monitoring staff is off right now, and this is literally the busiest time of the year with both the Lower Columbia urban streams testing and the IDI and the bug surveys and hydrology and all the other things that are going on. So the guys are just going like crazy to try and make sure they get everything done and do everything correctly, professionally, and safely, you know, and they need to go out in separate vehicles and do all of the COVID protocols in addition to all of the regular safety protocols. So there's a lot involved there. I know I'd even volunteer to go out and help if they needed a second person to go out and at least be a safety person, they haven't had to have that yet, so I know that's been an option that's been out there. Let's see. Also, just a lot going on with La Center and the IDI and local source control. Bob Patterson, he came out and talked back in May, I think, with Chad, and he came and talked, and he's had a lot going on. New grant has just hit our desk this week, or no, it's not really a grant, but the new contract for the Department of Ecology's funding for that, and we have a number of those kind of contracts that are needing to be finished, as well as just we're so overwhelmed right now with projects and grants and things that we don't have the bandwidth right now to do anything more without seriously complicating and compromising quality. And so we've had to take a step back away from any funding and grant sources, go after anything competitive, just because we just don't have the staff to be able to handle that. And in fact, I'm probably going to start taking some classes on project management so I can start helping, hopefully, in some of those ways. GIS and mapping?
Can I ask, as far as, like, routing people to you guys, or is there hiring going on to try to fill those positions?
Right now, our positions, there's nobody that is, they're just off right now for personal issues. Potential, you know, medical leave. Yeah, we're just completely understaffed right now. We don't have any permanent positions open. Hopefully, knock on wood.
That is one thing that I'm working on. I am trying to justify getting us more people. This is in front of Eva, and she's completely on board with it. It's just a matter of having the reasoning down to put in front of council to present to them in a way that they agree clean water needs more people.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you know, because you remember when Carrie came and talked about the private stormwater facility inspections. You know, we have two people doing the work of six. So
before you have maternity leave and family leave. And,
So we just, we have been at capacity forever, and right now we're actually at a point where we just don't have the staffing to be able to go any further. So we're hopefully looking into that.
I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
Would additional staffing that you're going to be trying to convince the council of, would that mean general fund dollars or other sources of funding?
Clean Water is an enterprise fund. It's not general fund dollars. It comes from the fees. So it's specifically, you know, general fund dollars I don't think can actually be used for our stuff, but I know for sure our money cannot be used for anything other than clean water. So it's a dedicated fund source. So
if the money is there, it's just a process of getting the council approval to expend it?
Mm-hmm.
That, and I feel like the division's been pretty successful at going after grants lately. So there's plenty of grant money around being spent right now that's, you know, not really impacting the pot of money that comes from fees and everything, so.
Right. So do you feel like you're moving toward a more stable time, or for whatever reason, and I don't need to know all the reasons, that things have been in upheaval, are things corrected, or is it, I just wonder, are there still problems? Are we still in upheaval, or are we moving into a calmer, stable period?
You're talking about public works wide?
Yeah.
More or less, over the last month, I believe two other new division managers have started, and they have interviews coming up for another division manager, Parks. So the fact that I believe, if I remember right, there's seven division managers and three of us are new and one more is being interviewed. I feel like we're moving towards a little bit of stability for some amount of time. Like Alice just said, you know, fingers crossed, knock on wood, throw some salt over your shoulder. It feels like things have started to stabilize a little bit. I don't want to speak too soon and count on my chickens or anything, but it's just the general feeling for me over the last week, and I don't know if that's me settling into the job or if that's, you know, truly a wider spread feeling, but the fact that at least three divisions have new permanent managers installed, I think helps. So that's my feeling on it.
Nice. It's just a concern that if they make problems, it'd be good to hope that that might get addressed, whatever it might be. Thanks.
Yes, Josh?
I'm looking for some clarification. So is there unexpended clean water fees in that dedicated funding that could be used to increase the number of FTE in the clean water division? Or is it an issue of those funds are fully allocated or nearly fully allocated and there needs to be additional funding, whether it's through fee increases or through general fund dollars or some other source? Is there funds that are unexpended and just going to sit there as a reserve that could be used for additional full-time employees?
Personally, I want to take a close look at that and figure it out. And that's what I'm hoping to show, is that especially with all the growth in Clark County recently and probably moving forward from here, you know, our funding is hopefully not going to go downwards. But I'm hoping that helps support bringing in more people so that we don't have two people acting as six, for one. And we don't have to put a hold on going after grant money that's going to support doing some really interesting projects. I mean, one of the grants that we have right now is Heritage Farms. And I believe the other thing that comes to mind is that grant is actually going to need to get extended by a year. I'm going to have to request that extension from Ecology because the permitting timeline on that is just so long. That's a side effect. My understanding is that these grants are generally a three-year period, just automatically. That's the grant period, unless an extension is requested, and often an extension has to be requested, and usually it's a pretty understandable reason. An 18-month permitting timeline falls under that. So that's an update that I forgot about. Heritage Farms. I think all of you longtime commissioners are familiar with that one. But anyway, you know, we've kind of put a hold on going after grants because we just don't have the capacity to chase after grants that support some of these projects, which is unfortunate.
Thank you, Justin, for that. So, it sounds like you feel like there needs to be a closer look taken at the budget to see for sure. Part of what I'm hearing also, and this is something I wouldn't ask you to comment on just because I don't want you to put yourself in a troublesome position, but it may be that the council needs to come up with general fund dollars to supplement that that fee-based money just because of the size of the need and the difficulty of collecting more fees in some cases. One example that I think is a case in point is the failed stormwater facility that's sometimes been called a wetland and is known to the HOA as an engineered stormwater facility that's actually become a polluted source due to lack of maintenance and so on. And so that's a private stormwater facility that's not the county's responsibility for maintenance and so on, but the HOA's. And it seems to, from that and from other cases, that like just even the enforcement on checking those out, doing some water quality testing to verify the efficacy of older facilities and so on, rather than just trusting the HOAs and so on to do that work, like it seems like that right there is a need. And there's no fee money for that, right? Because there's no private, you're not getting a fee. It's the HOA's responsibility, but they don't know about water quality testing, and they don't know about that these things are not magic pits, but that you have to clean them out and remove phosphorus and sediment periodically and do replantings and so on. So I just kind of want to highlight that, throw that idea out there, that this may be something where there needs to be some general fund basically derived from the property taxes generated from these housing developments to look at that piece specifically, and there may be others that I would be interested in hearing about as well.
The one I remember reading about recently, I think that was in City of Camas, if I remember right. The facility that you're talking about, is the one next to Lacamas Lake, or is it a different one?
That's the one.
Yeah, I was recently reading an article about
a lawsuit against the HOA and City of Camas, I believe, on that one. But it's a great example of a problematic facility. These two inspectors that Alice mentioned that do the work of six, they take on the private facility inspection. And you're touching on an important point, something that I really is a legitimate concern is the number of those facilities that they have to inspect. It's constantly increasing. I think we added 170 of them in the last year, if I remember the number right. And what scares me about that is the amount of time that can be dedicated to an inspection and follow-ups, as the follow-ups are probably more important. And they do an excellent job keeping up. I'm not saying that they're not doing a good job. I'm just saying that there's got to be a tipping point where two people just isn't going to be enough to keep up with inspecting those private facilities and doing the follow-ups. And right now, up to now, we've been doing a great job inspecting 100% of those facilities, following up where it's needed, and taking whatever actions are necessary. That is all documented as part of our permit reporting requirements. So, but it is an important consideration.
Well, while we're providing constructive criticism to an already overworked staff, I would just follow up on what Josh is saying about the fact that the part that I always see as disappointing is that the way the development follow through to infrastructure maintenance and monitoring and mitigation works in this county currently puts you all in a position of constantly playing catch up, and you're chasing around problems, cleaning up, versus it being geared towards, it feels like it is more that versus being geared towards a system that's designed to sustainably maintain itself, that, you know, we're going to build this, then these resources are here to maintain this status quo. And I know that's the spirit and the effort, but there is kind of that sense sometimes that the way the structure comes out puts a huge amount of pressure on you guys to try to put out fires constantly.
So one of the other things that actually is at least being talked about is having Clean Water be more involved in the inspection of those facilities before the subdivisions are finished. And it's another workload. It's not something that, I mean, I think it would touch on fixing that issue of these facilities being finished and then, you know, almost too immediately just not quite being in compliance. We wouldn't be playing catch up that way. We'd be getting input early on before they're finished, and hopefully it would head off some of those problems.
I really think that that's also another opportunity for direct one-on-one, case-based, you know, example-based of education that people would really find beneficial, those who are designing and building and maintaining.
Thank you for that add-in, Brendan. I just want to clarify, I am not in any way being critical of the Clark County staff. I think the policy structure they're operating in is destined for trouble when you have elected homeowners association boards with no experience for the most part in water resources and a lot of turnover being tasked with managing these. And I think that the county council approves the zoning decisions and so on, and then they don't provide the follow-up to ensure water resources are being protected. And honestly, that the health and happiness of the Clean Water Division employees are being protected because they're being tasked with something that's nearly impossible without, it sounds to me, like adequate funding support. So I would really like to see more general fund support to reflect the fact that the county as a whole is benefiting from, financially speaking, from development. And I would like to see the county having the capacity to do periodic performance testing on the private HOA or business operated stormwater facilities so that the county can come in, or even require the owner to pay for a third-party laboratory to do kind of influent, outfluent sampling and substrate sampling within the facility to ensure that they're capturing nutrients, they're capturing metals, and not becoming the source of nutrients and metals. So I think the county is doing a great job with too few resources, and I think on these private facilities there needs to be more, and that includes both in the terms of what the council wants done for ensuring efficacy and water resource protection, and also support that the county is giving to the Clean Water Division and staff.
I would just like to very much agree with Josh's comments and just say that if there, I mean, because we as a commission can make recommendations, can communicate directly to the council, and I think we're here to support you in your work, and ultimately the buck will stop with the council if there's liability issues and they're unable to ultimately meet the requirements of the permit. But I do think that the staff is doing a stellar job under really difficult circumstances with limited resources. So I would just say, you know, if there's a role that we can play, and we maybe can talk amongst ourselves about the role that we might play in communicating with the council, but to do it in a way that is supportive would ultimately result in some positive things happening for the department.
I'd like to speak, and I can't see my hand because I got a background. Yeah, because we make our annual report to the council, but I think that's waiting too long. I think if we can do a memo, a letter like we do for other supports, talking about the need for more people right now and the why and the quality issues, you know, something nice. And then if Justin needs to go to the council to ask for funding or positions, he has the support of Clean Water and he has something to back him up. I think that might be helpful.
I think that's a great idea on that. And we're preaching to the choir if we let you guys know you're overworked. So.
I have a couple other things really quick. Sorry, Brendan.
No, go ahead, Ross.
I know. I actually have a lot to talk about this time, surprisingly. I haven't even got to my importance, the other new stuff. So my sense is, and let me know, I've had Jeff Schnabel come in multiple times over the past few years to talk about the 6-year plan as well as potentially the 20-year plan. Do you want me to have him come in and talk again about the 6-year capital planning, or do you want to give it a break for a year? That was one of the ones that we've traditionally done in the fall. Or would you rather... because I don't know where we'll be with the 20-year plan right now. I know we're working on it, but I don't know where we'll be, you know, if it's going to be anywhere near in a place where we can present.
In relative to incorporating kind of a letter to this discussion into that?
Potentially, but more along the lines of just we do our annual 6-year capital planning. This is where we're going to be, you know, these are the projects, this is what we have going forward. I know that capital planning is definitely going to be a large aspect, but it is going to be probably much more geared towards the potentially the financial needs for the 20-year plan. Because I know Jeff talked about that last year, you know, in the number of pipes and, you know, the miles of pipe that need to be fixed and potentially are going to start failing, and dealing with emergency versus proactive and inspections and things like that. But I don't know if we will have anything ready before the end of the year or if it'll be later, just the way life is going now. But but maybe we might have something by the 20-year plan. I just don't know, you know, where that'll be, but I can definitely, you know, have him come in and do a short 6-year plan if you would like in either October or November, or if you'd like to, I don't know how much it's going to change. You know, it obviously changes a little bit every year, but what's your opinion?
I mean, I think it would be good to... Sorry, Sue. Yeah.
Okay. I would just say I'd be happy to hear from Jeff and whatever kind of update he might okay. have and his sense of prioritizing needs. And I think it better informs us as to really what the overall need may be and all the more reason for more resources for the
city. Okay.
I was going to say that I think that that would be good protocol anyway, is that he's moving forward with those plans, we'd be hearing those, adding our letters of support with it. I know it's been several years conversation about those plans being dialed such that they're looking at reserves for estimated infrastructure needs long term, and I don't know, A, how much he wants to muddy the waters with, you know, other additional requests into that. I mean, it's kind of a presentation of this is how we want to gear the budget as it currently is to deal with the problems we know we have coming. To the topic we were just talking about, I was thinking that that would be a little bit more pressing. As Marie and Sue both mentioned, you kind of have a contemporary problem right now. There's what we're seeing with staff. And I think it would be who of us to put together a letter that went forward earlier, especially if Justin's going to be presenting something in an earlier timeline that just says, you know, in our position of trying to see what's happening in the county, this is what we notice, and this is our input. And that letter might be attached to Jeff's report come wintertime as well. But I think it would be nice to do something earlier.
I'd be happy to do an outline, and then have you guys put the input in for the, especially Josh, with your knowledge, you know, about the water quality.
I'd be happy to take an outline and run with it a little bit.
Okay, we can work on that if you'd like. I can hold you.
Thanks for taking that one, Marie.
What would our timeline be to get this letter to the council?
I think that they vote on the budget usually in end of November, first part of December, and they'll give presentations, is it early mid-November? So I think if I'm remembering correctly the budgeting process, I'm trying to remember, maybe Justin can get with Marie and Josh, and you guys, and we can work together on knowing what the what would be the appropriate timeline for that, and when would be the most impactful.
I agree, because I mean I'm in the pretty early stages of looking at it. And I'm wondering if doing it now and then having months go by before officially bringing it to the council, because I know there's no way it's going to fit into the current budget. But I'm talking to Eva about ways that it can happen, you know, in advance of the next budget and all of that. There sounds like there are ways to have the council consider letting it go forward ahead of time. So that's, like I said, I've been around 6 weeks, so still figuring some of this policy and procedure stuff out. You know, everybody around me helps. Alice is a good knowledge base. But I think Alice has an important point. We just need to figure out when it's going to be most impactful.
Well, and I just my thought on this is that there could be some sense. I know time is precious in each of these meetings, and you know, if they're going through to approve a particular budget, you're not necessarily going in there thinking you're going to walk away with it, but our role in the community and the open forum to present concerns, it could be something that we could go in earlier and say, this is something we notice, this is something that we are going to continue to advocate for with multiple budget requests coming forward, and it just kind of puts that seed in the ground on that, and then we can keep working on it. So I think that it would be good to be there in accompaniment with what you or Jeff are presenting, but maybe we can even get something up there earlier that's just advocating the idea.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, as long as some thoughts put into, you know, how it's presented now versus, you know, now, hey, we understand that now is the time that they're going for it. Just a reminder here, we've been advocating for this. It's probably a good way to approach it.
I think it builds also on the messages that we've been giving in the annual presentations for the last 2 or 3 years, where we're talking more about being proactive, getting ahead of the emergencies, and looking at things on a watershed and source management aspect in order to, you know, really to trim costs and to better manage workloads through not having as many fires, to put out, so to speak. So I'm fully on board with this approach that we're taking.
Yeah, and I mean, the whole pipe system inspection and 20-year plan approach to things, it fits in with the timelines of the comp plan, too. I mean, if you look at it, the comp plan looks out to 2035, and that was, it's not a brand-new document or anything. So it fits in with other planning efforts in the county, and personally, I think it's a responsible thing to do. My point with the 20-year plan is that it supports, better looking at how our fee and fee structure need to evolve over time, rather than being very reactive about, hey, the fee's not high enough, let's ram through getting it revised based on what we're doing right now. Having that 20-year planning horizon, at least in my opinion, supports sort of a more comprehensive look at that.
And we may need to send this to the council, you know, before they adopt this year's budget. Based on the way that planning these budgets works for the fire district where I'm a commissioner, we're putting together drafts now. We're going to be voting stuff through and sending it on to the county treasurer in November. And so, you know, it might be already too late to really get additional funds or real changes to the budget this year. But I think by raising it during the budget time this year and then coming back around, you know, towards the, in our July or September meeting next year as well, I mean, this can be something the commission can keep pushing over a couple budget cycles to really get the point across, because it's not going to, I don't expect this to take hold one way or the other. It might be something we need to be persistent about, you know, this year and then the next year and then so on, that there is some probably systemic issues that maybe the Lacamas Lake HOA's stormwater facility is just the tip of the iceberg, and it would be good to get ahead of it, both environmentally but also economically, because cleaning up Lacamas Lake, decreasing the phosphorus load, and dealing with the lost revenue from recreation impacts from toxic algal blooms and so on, that all costs money. Pollution costs money, environmental damage costs money, and so I think this might be something to try to send a little earlier in the budget process this year, just my 2 cents, and then just keep hitting it. I think our new clean water manager can make the case from his side, and as a commission, our role is, as Brendan articulated, we get to talk directly to the council without having to worry about getting in trouble.
I was getting wrapped up in this conversation enough to forget what time it was, so I wanted to do a time check real quick. I see that it's 7:50 already, and I really want to be conscious of our presenter this evening's time. So I'd like to stay on this conversation kind of in emails following up. So it sounds like, Marie, you're going to start on that letter. Alice, I'll probably be in touch with you on that. If we can look at like some dates for when we can make initial presentations and see what we can do to kind of keep some momentum behind this.
Okay.
I just kind of wanted to move through the rest of our agenda a little bit here so we can get to our speakers.
Sure. I do have one other thing, though. It's actually my big one.
Please.
And I'll put this on the agenda for the October meeting as well to discuss. As you probably all know, because I've talked about it in the past, where the Clean Water Managers have been very, very supportive of DEI work, diversity, equity, and inclusion work. And actually, Jeff and Justin has continued this. They actually asked me to give presentations during our staff meetings. And so I have been giving presentations, basic education, and we've been moving towards aspects that have been coming up and a number of different topics. And one of the things that I'm really excited about, but I'm also a little daunted, one of our staff realized there was a Bob Patterson, actually, the local source control. He was talking with a number of other staff members, and there was questions about some pipes that were being, and pumps that, and stations that were being mapped. And there was a general conversation with about four or five different people, and they had, well, what's this pump? And they had gone and they pulled the technical description from the supplier's website and said, this is it. And Bob pointed out, and then CC'd me on it, that it was something that he was very unhappy about and actually did not support the naming of the way this pump was named. And he would like to look at ways that we can change it industry-wide. It was a master pump and a slave pump. And
it was actually the valves.
Oh, that's right. Master valve and a slave valve. And then they got into some of the other industry aspects. And they were looking at maybe seeing if potentially the Clean Water Commission could help on a bringing out and advocating or doing some type of education and talking with industry or whatever to advocate towards some change in that. With because it's obviously engaging in a much larger dialogue than what, you know, where we're more focused in and down in the weeds, but where you that was one of the things that they had mentioned was like, this might be a really great thing for the Clean Water Commission if you're able to potentially take that on and talk about it. So I wanted to present that as something that the staff has identified as an issue that's in the industry. Just came up like a week or so ago, 2 weeks ago, a week and a half ago, and I said I would bring it to you guys and see if there was anything that potentially that we could do as a commission and or talk with industry that's out there or whatever. So I'm letting you know what we have, and it's obviously a daunting opportunity, but it's definitely an opportunity to make an impact.
Yeah, I'd be curious about digging into that one, on the next meeting of the conversation. I know it ties in with the creek naming piece a little bit as we presented that, and the primary difference on that is that you have jurisdiction over how you name geographical bodies in the county. There's a process for doing that. When you're talking about a mechanical part, there can be some difficulty to it. I know I've personally experienced this working with irrigation pieces and had staff. The company I was working with, you know, asked, well, can we call it this or that, whatever term they wanted to use to feel more comfortable with it. And I would express to them they could use whatever term they were comfortable with, but when you go to the shop to order a new part, you're probably going to need to know that this is what it's called if you want the guy behind the counter to know what you need. It's a much trickier public outreach to get behind that. So it is similar conversation, but a whole another realm to change that. So I'd be interested to brainstorm that one more.
And that's all I have.
See, on the agenda we have the replacement commissioner appointment.
Oh, that's right. It's Sandra Martin Bim. Did I say Bim right? Sandra?
It's Martin Bain.
Bain, sorry. I was thinking of our last fearless leader. We had a number of candidates that were on the last selection pool, and to replace Justin and Sandra. One of the candidates declined. He has some other things that he's working on right now. There were two candidates, and the committee felt Sandra would be the best fit overall, that would meet some of the diverse aspects of what we... I guess we're kind of lacking in the fact that, you know, having the transportation aspect, and we have the other candidates are really strong, as a really great candidate, have strongly encouraged them to please apply again for the next year if anything comes open, or if anything does open up for some reason in the rest of this term, that we would definitely be very interested in talking and having them apply again, because they are a very strong candidate. Just overall, the committee felt that Sandra was a really, really good fit and added a new diversity aspect to the group with her experience. Sorry about that, Sandra. And we've already kind of introduced you. We're submitting the recommendation to the county manager. County manager, as you know, will appoint. And then council is on break through the middle part of September. And so then they will, hopefully we can get them on, get her appointment on for the end of September 1st of October to get her appointed and officially approved. So,
do we need to make any motion as a council at all, or we're just okay?
No, it'll come from recommendations from staff to the county manager. County manager appoints, and then the council approves.
Good deal. Well, Sandra, thanks for being able to attend tonight and get kind of a preview before you're officially on board. Happy to have you with us.
I'm super happy to be joining the group. I apologize for not being on video. I'm actually camping on the local Moon River right now, gazing out over the Columbia, which is always a gorgeous sight. So happy to join from vacation.
Excellent. Well, thanks for taking the time. So working groups, Michelle, do you have an update for research team?
Brendan sent out a nice letter that most of us had reviewed that now has gone out to the rest of the commission for our renaming of Shanghai Creek and China Ditch, hopefully. So we already got a response from Michelle Gertz about somebody who potentially help us, if anything, to know who to reach out to, but also has a lot of information on the history. We have not had a meeting, but we will for the next, maybe not the next meeting, the next regular meeting, the next regular meeting for sure. But that is where we are right now. And I think we're slowly making progress tonight. We do still need to come up with a new topic to research. So I think we're going to start doing some ideas soon, and I'm just
Connor has opinions.
Thank you. Matt, do you have an update for us for outreach?
Not too much. Maria and I have still been working on the Salmon Safe issue, or exploring it, at least. We've been talking a little bit about what selling, I guess, what the value add would be to the county, because the Salmon Safe certification for parks does come with an assessment fee, which is, as an estimate, somewhere in the $25,000 to $50,000 range. So there definitely is a cost associated. We can cross that bridge, I guess, when we get there. First, we need to get some support behind it. So Marie and I are scheduled, I think, and maybe Alice, you could help us confirm this, to go to the Parks Advisory Board on October, looking at my notes, October 12th. Mm-hmm. At least that's what I have a hold on my calendar for. And to go before that citizen commission and see, get some feedback and see if there's some interest in pursuing this further or just letting it lay where it is.
It's a great project idea. I like the idea, but that is a price tag.
It is, yes. Yeah, especially if the county is already stretched a little thin with, we had a conversation about personnel. So, again, for us, it's making the case of what the value add is. And maybe they're, you know, I'm always optimistic about donor money as well. So I think that's definitely an option. But we need folks in the county behind it.
Yeah.
Then we'll find the money. I'm a little less worried about the money. I think we can find that. I could be wrong.
Have you already gotten a hold of what the criteria are? Like what that inspection, if you will, would be looking at to make that certification?
So I don't have the full assessment documents that they use, and I'm not sure if we can get them. I can certainly, or whether that's proprietary in some form, you know, I can investigate that. A lot of the information about what they talk about related specifically to stormwater is on the websites under parks and what they look at, but I'm not sure as far as the assessment documents that they use internally, if those are publicly available, they would be willing to let me see those. But certainly a conversation I'm willing to have if we can get just a nibble of support from the county. I didn't want to go too far down this road. The support. If the support's not there, the support's not there, but I haven't been able to really get a yes or no. Well, I haven't been able to get an answer. But as we've talked about, we've had a lot of turnover in staff as well. So,
yeah. I really like this idea, so I don't want to add anything to discredit it, but it's kind of funny, just anecdotally, the idea of, like, you can't see the credentials, but if you pay me $50,000, I will sleep.
Right, yeah. No, I hear what you're saying, and I don't think it's a money-making scheme. You know, I could be wrong, certainly, but I really don't think that. I mean, it's a local organization, and they really believe in what they do, so... You know, like any organization, it costs. There's a cost to running the organization and a cost to dealing with us. So, you know, if we want to get certified, it costs them something. There's going to be an associated fee with that.
Yeah, no, I think it'd be great for parks to be able to try to reach.
At what site they do list what they're looking for. And
okay.
There's a lot of information there.
So. Yeah, thanks, Marie. They do definitely have a lot of information on the website. I don't know if it's in totality of what that's what they use for, but anybody who's interested in, I really encourage you just go to the Salmon Safe website, local organization, and they have a list of some of the other parks, Seattle and Portland, that have signed on to get certified.
Right.
I had a question. Is that fee per park, or is that just like for the county, or how's that work?
It's the overall fee, and I'm going back here quickly to, that's a good question, to my email if I can. There we go. Is the assessment fee that is the entire cost of the park system? So I'm quoting here from the email, for a 5-year certification cycle. Ranging from $25,000 to $50,000, depending on scale and complexity of the parking of the park, excuse me, the park system. So, you know, the person I spoke with, who's the co-founder and executive director, believes that we're probably at the higher end of that 50,000, just given the number of parks that we have and the complexity of them as well. And the assessment takes about 10 months or so. So it's not a quick sort of come in, pay me money, and now you're certified. It looks like they actually spent some time doing stuff.
I imagine it might mean that maintenance of parks might need to change in order to comply as far as pesticide, herbicide use management of the parks. So that would be a good first stop to see how closely their criteria might conflict or be compatible with what we're, how much change would actually have to occur and what the cost of that might be for the Parks Department.
Yeah, I could tell you, I'm looking at the memo that we're working on. So they do the overall management policies, they do random field samples, and they assess the projects that are going on, the standards of water quality, water quantity, fish habitat, fish passage. You have to have inventory and mapping, and there is an integrated pest management plan.
And I put the link in the chat there for anybody who's interested. That's what some of the information Marie's reading off there. Again, there's a wealth of information there. They are a nonprofit, so the assessment fees will sort of cover the work that they have to do, but looks like King County Parks is also out midway through the cycle of getting certified. So.
And just so since we're in a public meeting, it does say the HTTPS salmonsafe.org. So if you go to salmonsafe.org, that would be what's there. And then the other comment that was made in the chat before during the meeting was that Sandra said, "Great to meet everybody. Happy joining the commission." And prior to that, it was just before the meeting started, people wanting to know whether or not their mute was on or if people could hear them. So that's all that's been put into the chat.
So there is a document that I came across. The title of it is Salmon Safe Certification Standards for Parks and Natural Areas, and it goes into some level of detail on their evaluation process and their certification standards. That's the title of the document that they put out there. It's May 2019.
Well, thanks, Matt. I look forward to hearing more about that and hopefully get some more traction over there at Parks.
Yeah, so we'll let you know. And if quickly, while I have the floor, the Lower Columbia Estuary Partnership was supposed to have their annual event mid-September. I was hoping to see some, if not all of you there. Due to COVID, that is no longer going on, but they are still having an event. If you're not aware of it, it's sort of a scaled-down event on the evening of the 25th, which is a Saturday. And it's going to be at Vancouver Lake, so it's a little bit more local for us. There is a reduced fee for the event since it doesn't cover as much, but the entrance fee, if you will, does cover what they're calling now a to-go dinner. So it's going to be socially distanced. They did have a caterer, so they wanted to make sure and follow through with that. There'll be dessert. The big canoes will be out there, and by big canoes I mean 26 feet, so that's an option, as I understand, for you to take a ride in one of those canoes if you want. I'm going to put the link to the registration in the chat. Alice, I'm sorry, this is probably not one that you're going to be able to read verbatim, since it's quite lengthy, but
if somebody goes to LSEP's website, though.
Yeah, exactly. If you go to the Lower Columbia Estuary Partnership's website, I am sure you will find it front and center, because they do want people to attend, and definitely could put the money, the cost of attendance, to good use.
I'll make sure that it is put available on in the notes and in the webs on available as one of the items for the extra backup documents.
Yep. And just, I mean, Lower Columbia Estuary Partnership's been doing some great work here locally. Recently, they've been doing some monitoring as East Fork of the Lewis River for temperatures, again, related to salmon. I'm sure everybody's probably aware here that our river temperatures have been quite high, so they've been paying special attention to that. And just a great organization, so I encourage everybody that can to attend. Thank you.
Second that. Michelle, you have a report for partnerships.
Well, I can keep this fairly brief. Sandra, welcome aboard, and I'm hoping, as the chair of the partnerships group, that you'll be interested in joining us. And as soon as we get you formalized, I'll be sending you an email to try to see if you and Sue and I can get together to look at what partnerships can do. I think, you know, one of the opportunities that I hear here tonight is that perhaps there's a way to complement some of the things if indeed there isn't a way to expand staff this year. Maybe there's a way to complement through partnerships with other groups and getting grants locally to offset some of the workload, accomplish some of the things the clean water staff really want to do. So, and if not actually coming to fruition this next year, at least laying the groundwork, and then that can be referenced within the next year for the next budget cycle, still to complement and show efficiencies in how the Clean Water Group is going about doing their business and realizing their goals. So at this point, we're in a planning phase, and we need to sort of look at all of the cards that we have and make some priorities and touch base more with Justin in that regard. That's the plan for the next couple of months.
Thank you, Michelle.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, finally, getting to our presentation. I'm sorry, Tanya, that you get to attend the full meeting before coming to this part. And real quickly, one more item before I move the microphone over to you. I was wanting to ask Allison, we can talk about this more later, if we have the ability in the future, and we have a guest speaker, to slide that up the schedule for their sake. There's nothing in some bylaws that I'm unaware of. That
no, and then I thought, and I had actually had told her that we would be like 15 minutes. Because normally we're really, really quick. We actually talked a lot. So I was like, oh, you know, it would be like 15 minutes worth of business, and then we'll get to the meat and potatoes. And so,
well, I don't
apologize.
Know how much time you kind of calculate for your presentation, Tanya. I, for one, am going to be available for how much time you have. I can't speak for the rest of the council, but I'd love to see the full part of your presentation, so don't feel like you need to abridge it at all. And if anybody does need to leave this evening, I would say just sign off at that point. You know, appreciate everybody being here. But yeah, I'll hand it over.
Well, I'll ask, does anybody need a short break before we get started? Do you need to stand up or move or anything?
I've been doing video meetings all day, firmly planted in my chair.
Okay, all right then. Well, here comes the next big challenge. So as all of you were saying, when we first started this meeting about Teams and Zoom and BlueJeans and a couple of platforms I wasn't familiar with, I am going to try to share my screen and we're going to see, this is great. This is WebEx. WebEx lets me pick my screen. Google just kind of randomly chooses one for me. So I think that you can actually see my screen now. Is that right? Can you?
Yes.
Yeah,
Tony. I can see that. I see a PowerPoint from you.
I do too.
That would be my screen. That's the one. Hey, everybody, I want to say thank you again for inviting me to be here. And I actually didn't mind listening to the meeting at all. I thought it was fascinating, and I have a deep love for how policy is made and how governments function, and what you do really falls into some areas that I do quite a bit of work in. Just to reintroduce myself really quickly for you, I'm Tanya Settles, and with the Kaleidoscope Group. And the Kaleidoscope Group is actually a diversity, equity, and inclusion consultancy firm. And if I say so myself, I think that they're pretty good at it. So what we have at the Kaleidoscope Group are a number of different practice areas. And the one that I support is our state and local governments and public safety areas. And we have a lot that keeps us busy, but one of the really weird areas of work that I work in quite a bit anymore has to do with natural disasters and how natural disasters overlie with crime in communities. So, and I have a background on training in emergency management, so it wasn't very difficult at all for me to think about how diversity, equity, and inclusion could help and support the work, the incredibly important work that you're doing with the Clark County Clean Water Commission. And like I mentioned before, I have family in Clark County, so I don't know, it felt very homey to me. And again, I really, really appreciate the invitation to be here. So there's a couple of things that I'm looking forward to sharing with you tonight. And the first one is an invitation to be consciously inclusive. And conscious inclusion is intentional and it's deliberate, and it speaks to how you interact with each other and members of the Clark County community. And then the next thing that I really want to talk about is how you can leverage diversity, equity, and inclusion to be a higher performing government, how you can use DEI to help you do your job better and more efficiently and in better service to the people in Clark County. So let me start by walking you through this slide about what conscious inclusion is. And conscious inclusion means being intentional, purposeful, and deliberate in every action that you take, and consider a variety of perspectives, experiences, and knowledge in a way that you may not have fully considered before, particularly when it comes around to policy advocacy. It means going out of your way a little bit to ensure that you make decisions, even mundane decisions, even the day-to-day stuff that we think about, in a way that's intentional and deliberately inclusive, that you're thinking beyond yourself, beyond what your needs are, and trying to consider the needs and really experience the needs of someone else, someone you might not even be that familiar with. And this is important because what this does is it provides you an opportunity to engage in diversity of thought. And diversity of thought actually causes people to make better decisions. There's quite a bit of research about diversity of thought, and we find that those decisions that are made from that standpoint are actually more, apart from being more inclusive, they're also more accurate and they're more innovative. So when you're thinking about being consciously inclusive and intentional, you really have to think about You have to think constantly. Now, one thing that I learned listening to your, to the meeting agenda is you think a lot. this is a group of people who thinks, and what I heard and what I saw in listening to the parts of the meeting before now is that you think a lot about your community and community impact and how to bring the community into the fold. How to make good decisions for the community. And that's great. And I hope that I'll have some good tips for you at the end on how to expand on those relationships with the community. But you also have to believe. And part of believing means that you have to challenge your own biases and be willing to explore what that means for you, and then demonstrate being consciously inclusive by adapting your behavior, or sometimes even completely changing your behavior or the behavior of an organization to achieve a greater goal. And after practice, and it does take practice, you'll actually become better at this, and it becomes almost like second nature. And it's worth the effort. It really, truly is. So another thing I wanted to talk with you about is where DEI development evolution. And these are the reasons why people call, why organizations call people like us, like the Kaleidoscope Group. And starting at the top of what you see on the slide you see in front of you, there's this idea that something bad happened. We get a lot of calls like this. Something bad happened, and some HR department somewhere decides that they need to correct a problem, and so they create compliance training and then have us come in and deliver it. And they're really just trying to correct a problem. And that's a good reason to call us, but it's not the best reason to call us. And moving along the continuum a little bit, another reason people call is that they're trying to be nice, that they're trying to avoid a problem or not cause a problem. Also, a really good reason to call us. But my favorite part about the DEI development scale or evolution continuum is where we get into valuing and leveraging differences between us to understand what makes us different from each other, so that we can build more powerful and more innovative solutions. Next up is managing bias, particularly unconscious bias or implicit bias, and that leads to avoiding the unintended. But the gold standard here is conscious inclusion, meaning that we have the opportunity to achieve the things that we intend to achieve by leveraging diversity, equity, and inclusion. And sometimes we'll hear a little bit, diversity, equity, and inclusion becomes a little bit complicated. Very often it becomes complicated because of the many terms around it. Diversity for us, from the Kaleidoscope Group perspective, just refers to that variety of abilities, skills, and experiences of people, and all of the experiences of people, cultural backgrounds, educational levels, places where people were born, regional preferences. Diversity is so much more than race and gender. Equity for us is important because it means establishing those policies and practices that create fair opportunities. But in addition to fair opportunities, that's where equality starts and ends. What equity looks at is outcomes for everyone. So it's looking through an entire process of policy change to see if what you're doing actually results in the outcomes that you're looking for in terms of serving the community that you do. Inclusion for us means valuing and leveraging. Oops, I'm losing control of my mouth. Valuing and leveraging differences to achieve really great superior results. So it's a surprise to people sometimes that when we think about what diversity, equity, and inclusion are, the members of my team think about it as a matter of government performance. How can we use the talents, skills, and abilities and experiences of everyone to make better decisions and create more efficient government and more responsive government? Lately, we used to stop at just DEI, but lately we're seeing a lot of people adding that term belonging. So you'll see references to DEIB. Belongingness is the sense that all people are welcome, that people belong, that they contribute to an organization. It's that sense that you get when you figure out that you are in the right place at the right time to make a difference. And the other thing about belongingness means that sometimes you're in a place where mistakes are made because we're not perfect people. I've never encountered a perfect person. I'm far from perfect myself. But when people have a sense of belonging, they recognize that sometimes mistakes will occur. And we learn from those mistakes and we do things better the next time, but the mistake isn't an indictment about someone as a professional or as a human. People who experience that sense of belonging make calculated and strategic risks, knowing that there's a risk of failure, but those risks are innovative and they're solutions-oriented. And that's why so many public organizations these days are really interested in looking not just at diversity, the variety of things that make us different, or equity, matching up what we do with our outcomes, to even inclusion, but they're trying to create a sense of welcomeness and belonging in the organizations
for the communities that they serve. Now, one more really important definition, I think, given the work that you do, has to do with water equity. And you've probably seen this. It comes from the U.S. Water Alliance. It says that water equity occurs when all communities, all of the people within them, actually have access to safe, clean, affordable drinking water and wastewater services, that they experience community resiliency, that they have a role in decision-making, and that they share the benefits that are economic, social, and environmental that comes from having well-regulated and well-structured and well-maintained water and wastewater systems. The other thing about water equity, though, is that it also means that community has a role in decision-making. They're stakeholders. They exist for reasons, not just to be consumers of the work that you do, but to actually participate in the work you do. And in government, very often what we see are kind of the government insiders. They're making decisions about water and environmental policy, and the community part of this just means that when we decide what we're going to decide in government, we're going to tell the community what to do with it. And that's leaving the community out of that decision-making process. So true water equity also means that everyone shares in the economic and the social and the environmental benefits, and they share the work of getting there. Just to make sure that we're, I think we know what diversity is. We hear about it all the time. We talk about it in the news. It's almost, you almost feel like you can't quite get away from it. But diversity is so much more than race. Race right now is dominating the national dialogue. And right behind it is gender and gender inequity. But diversity is so much more. We have a tendency to just look at what's above the waterline in terms of dimensions of diversity, and that's just the stuff that you can see. Those primary dimensions, things like race, gender, skin color, appearance, physical traits, how you talk, tone of voice, whether you have an accent or if you don't. But if you look just below that waterline, just a little tiny bit, there's so much more that makes us who we are, that strengthens what our defines and strengthens what our values are, that includes things like profession, where we were born, our nationality, gender orientation, religion, parental status, where you work, your experiences, and so many more things that I can't even begin to name here. And people, I think in the work that we do, people are always surprised to hear that when we talk about diversity and equity and inclusion, we mean all of these dimensions of diversity, equity, and inclusion. We don't feel like it should be restricted to race or gender or orientation. So you've got a lot of definitions here, and probably thinking, why does DEI, or you might be thinking, why does DEI matter to the Clark County Clean Water Commission? And there's a lot of reasons why. First is the obvious, and you state it all the time in your communication with each other and with the county and with the community. Everyone lives downstream. So the decisions that you make actually have a significant and important impact on the people who live in the communities. And rain might fall in really fairly equal amounts over any given region, but the effects of that rainfall and the runoff that occurs after affects different people very differently, and it depends on a lot of factors, like where you live. Do you live in low-lying areas, or do you happen to live on higher ground? Whether your community is actually prepared to ride out a storm, whether they've made the investment that needs to be made in infrastructure, whether there's vulnerability to urban flooding. And I heard you mention earlier today, in fact, I heard you mention a lot of the things that I was hoping to talk about tonight. One of them was urban flooding, because urban flooding is particularly telling because it also reflects other social vulnerabilities that we may not think quite so much about. So the idea here is that vulnerability to urban flooding really mirrors those other things that happen. And another aspect to keep in mind is that low-income areas are often populated with people of color and non-native English speakers who may have been exposed to greater environmental hazards beyond access to clean water. They're also exposed to greater levels of air pollution. And while you don't, your commission doesn't deal with this, there are a number of commissions throughout the state, throughout the United States that do. And I'm thinking of those that are around the San Francisco area that actually deal with air quality in urban areas. And while I'm thinking of that, my community right now has an ozone warning out because the air quality is horrible, and we're also getting a nice cloud of smoke haze from fires that are burning in states west of here. So your ability to ride that out, for me, you know, when I think about it, I'm really lucky, and I do have a certain amount of privilege here. When I see that there's an air quality warning, I can close my windows, I can turn on my air conditioner, I can turn on the air purifiers that are throughout the house. But people who don't have access to those sorts of tools experience the same thing that's covering my state very differently, very, very differently than I do. Specifically, sorry, I got a little bit lost in my example there. Those areas that live in those low-income areas are also more likely to be in low-lying elevations. And so they're subject to repeated flooding. One of the things that really struck me when I was learning much more about the Clean Water Commission is how you've crafted your mission and your value statements that really connect you to, as having a stakeholder interest, not just directing the process, but being part of a collaboration with the community to develop a sustainability plan that addresses things like disproportionate impact among low-income neighborhoods and communities. And while you might not have specifically noticed those community characteristics, the hints are there in the mission and value statements, and it speaks to this objective. So there's so many things that you do. It was really difficult for me to really try to think, okay, you've got 15, 20 minutes to talk to this amazing group of people. What do we talk about? And I'm thinking, what don't we talk about? But I landed on something. And where I actually landed was to look at flooding and urban flooding for a couple of really important reasons. First, there's great financial risk associated with urban flooding, and most often that is the result of stormwater management. Second, diverse communities, and by diverse communities, you can think about Black, Indigenous communities, and people of color also tend to be concentrated, or there's a tendency to be concentrated in places that are prone to frequent flooding. So one of the striking characteristics about flooding is that it is incredibly expensive. Flooding is actually the most common and the most expensive disaster that we face in the United States. Across the planet, every year, we spend somewhere in the area of $83 billion in global natural disaster claims. $8 billion of that $83 billion, $8 billion are spent in the United States, or those are the expenses of insurance companies in the United States in economically marginalized areas, meaning that 10% of the global expenses that insurance companies pay out actually goes back to very often low-lying areas in economically marginalized places in this country, which is just astounding to me. And that's just for people who have insurance. We can't even really begin to get our arms around what happens to people when they don't have insurance. So there is an unequal ability to manage stormwater, or that unequal ability, rather, to manage stormwater really is connected to inequities that occur at institutional, at political, and at socioeconomic levels. And there are a number of people, and the U.S. Water Alliance and the International City and County Management Association also say that redlining actually had something to do with this. So redlining was actually abolished in the 1950s and 1968, to be specific. But most obvious practices still occur now. And as a result, black and brown communities and low-income populations tend to be located in those low-lying areas that flood more frequently. And the flood insurance is out of reach for them, even through the National Flood Insurance Program. Which isn't actually all, when you know, you look at the scope of what's affordable and what's not affordable and how you decide to spend the limited resources that households have, National Flood Insurance Program can be really, really pricey for people who work at significantly lower wages than other members of the community. It's not even something that they can think about. It's not that they don't want it. It's that they have to make decisions about, do I pay for food or do I pay for insurance? Do I pay for medicine or do I pay for insurance? So there are some people who make decisions really differently than other members of the community. And the other thing that we've really got to think about is that localized flooding events have increased three times, 300% in recent years. And there's really very few indicators of the rate of these localized flooding events is going to be reduced or dropped. To make things even just a little tiny bit more complicated, intersectional diversity creates even more negative impact. And things to consider as you think about how do we connect to the community, how do we take into consideration those perspectives that maybe we haven't thought about because they're different from our own. One of them is that urban areas, and this isn't a surprise to anybody who's here tonight, are particularly problematic. Accelerated development, population growth, and just the cost and expense of maintaining stormwater infrastructure can be overwhelming. I heard it today when you were talking about decisions at the county, that County Public Works is having to make about where do we put our investment and how do we get, you know, where does it go? You have a limited set of resources. Something that I think that we don't think about very often, though, is disproportionate impact. And just in the United States, from the National Flood Insurance Program, about 20% of all claim dollars that were paid by NFIP for the last decade were in zip codes where about 25%, if not more, residents were black. But those zip codes actually only accommodate or make up about 13% of the population. And the National Flood Insurance Program sees this as a disparity, that an indicator that there is disparate impact based on where people live. So quite a bit of group, as I mentioned, is located in Chicago. And Chicago and Cook County is spending a lot of time and intentional effort in trying to get a handle on urban flooding. And this is an example that I actually found in some of the work that they're doing of an elderly woman who has a physical disability. She has no private vehicle, so she relies on public transportation. She lives in a floodplain, and she has absolutely no homeowner's insurance or the ability to gain any. And when you think about what policy advice you make or you offer to the county, consider people who live with the experience of intersectional diversity and what guidance might you offer regarding infrastructure or other improvements that strengthens her resilience and people who are situated like her for future disasters that are related to stormwater flooding. And I know that counties make decisions with the best of intent. I spent a long time working in state and local government myself and trying to think through what some of these really complex decisions that you have to make. And
Hang on just a second.
Hi, okay, I think I'm back now. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
Oh, good, thank you. Sorry, my AirPod died. It said it was going to last, but it lied. Apple products. Okay. So, I'll move on to the next slide because I got really sidetracked by the fact that my AirPod died on me. And maybe let's talk about what some solutions might be for you and what those leading practices are that support environmental sustainability but still give you opportunities to bring in the community that you serve and think about how you can consciously include everybody in the community. So I hinted at this before, that integrating community into sustainability planning is actually pretty important. And recognizing that not all neighborhoods experience the same events in the same way. And I don't think that this is the case where you are. Well, I take that back. It is. You have multiple layers of government that are between the work that you do as an advisory council to the community members. So you may have people who live in cities like Vancouver, and in the event of flooding, you might be able to call in, you may see the Army Corps of Engineers, for example. The state has a stake in the decision-making that you have. And there are multiple water, in some places, like where I live, there's multiple water districts that almost overlap with one another, but not quite, but we all get our water from the same source, which is Denver Water, even though I'm not anywhere close to Denver. I'm about 30 miles outside of Denver. All of those things mean that people have different experiences and then layer on those dimensions of diversity. Also important is to define a sustainability plan that includes goals and objectives, and this is a big deal for me, measure them. Make sure that what you do is something that you can measure. Don't just set a goal that says we're going to we're going to be nicer to communities, the communities of color, for example. But actually figure out how do you measure and determine whether your efforts are meeting a planned objective. Also, I would suggest that you consider inclusive processes that intentionally invite perspectives from a variety of community members. But I hear that you're already doing this in a lot of important ways. That diversity of thought, it also gives you an opportunity to honor not just academic research or the type of research that you do, the work that you're doing to monitor water quality. It also means that you have an opportunity to reach out to the community and bring people in who have a completely different perspective and may have a perspective that you haven't had a chance to really consider. Also, build collaborative relationships with multiple partners. And one of your strongest partners, if it's not already, could actually be a Department of Public Health, because public health departments have a tendency to know where there are risks and in what places those risks are happening before you might even see that the risk or what they're seeing from a public health perspective is actually related to urban flooding. For example, vector control. When we start to see increases in diseases carried by creatures like mosquitoes, then that gives you a hint that there's something going on that might have to do with the water supply or with urban flooding or something that's occurring in a low-lying area in a way that you might not have thought about. I'm going to come back to this a couple more times. Measure. Identify performance indicators that are linked to the outcomes you want to see. And it doesn't have to just be outcomes related to improvements in water water quality or water access. It could be improvements to how you integrate community into your decision-making process. Now, in a lot of ways, I'm preaching to the choir here because you're all here as volunteers, and you're serving your community. But I think because you have that unique role, you're not paid, you don't work in a traditional sense, in the traditional, except for maybe Justin. I think Justin just went back to work. Except for maybe Justin. You have that connection to community, but expand on it, because there may be resources out there that you are just not quite as familiar with. So one of the things I really wanted to think about today is that, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion really is a statement about how you connect with the community that you serve and how you build those partnerships and bring people in to contribute. I was surprised, really, to see that you didn't have any community members attending this meeting. Where I live, this would have been, this would have been one of those go-to events for a lot of people in our community. And it might just be the time of day or the time of year or everybody sending kids back to school. But there are lots of opportunities to bring people in who actually want to help you achieve your mission. That's good news, because like you, they work for free in a lot of cases. So when you're building a community engagement process is built on diversity, equity, and inclusion. Number one stopping point is to always assume good intent. And the next step for a lot of communities that may be at greater risk than others is to acknowledge those historic injustices that have, like redlining, that have possibly contributed to factors associated with water, are factors rather associated with water challenges. And I've said this before in a couple of different ways, that it's important to honor the lived experience of people who live in a different place, who literally or metaphorically, who have a different experience in how they interact with government, who have different needs. That type of information is valuable and important. And then also look at, again, speaking to the choir here, you do a lot of research. That kind of research will help you, both in terms of academic information and technical expertise. But I can see that you're already drawing off of that type of work. Provide different types of engagement opportunities. What you've made a major commitment to supporting Clark County by being here. Not everybody has the opportunity to say, I am committing for a period of, what do you serve, two-year terms? I'm going to be there every other month. I'm going to commit to do this work. I'm going to go work on these subcommittees. I'm going to generate reports. I'm going to come up with ideas. It's a significant commitment. Other people may want to be as involved, but they still have a contribution to make. So look for various varied engagement opportunities and share power so that you make decisions that are continually be consciously inclusive. And, you know, a different sort of engagement opportunity might be something like a listening session, just creating opportunities for you to hear directly from, intentionally from community members about the needs and expectations that they have about clean water and things like urban flooding. Another part is, we run into this a great deal, is that people so badly want change around diversity, equity, and inclusion, and they want it like yesterday. That if we could get it like yesterday, it would not be fast enough. But there's a lot of value to slowing down and building trust, building partnerships with other government agencies, with professional associations, with nonprofits, and with community, with homeowners associations. I know there's 1,000 of those in Clark County. I think there might literally be like 1,000 more, maybe. Build trust with them, because they will help you do your job better. They'll help you make more enlightened and solution-oriented decisions. And again, going back to some of the good advice that I found about from the U.S. Water Alliance, be like water.
Water always finds a way. Water will always, always figure it out, and I think humans do too. So it feels like that was an awful lot of information, but I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have, and just say thanks again for letting me be here tonight.
To be fair, we do have one member of the community in attendance.
One member. I know, but he's such a cute new member. And he's still awake. That's okay, Connor. You can ask me questions when you learn how to talk, okay? I'll be around.
He's smiling. That's a good thing.
He's smiling. He does seem happy about it.
Yeah. I was like, I don't think you. That crazy lady is, but
really, Tanya, thank you. I think that's a great presentation. It really helped pull together in my mind a number of trains of thought and sort of observations and movements that I've seen both in general around diversity but more specifically in the water arena, thinking about water quality and flooding issues in that regard. So thank you.
You know, we did some work with the forest preserves in Illinois not too long ago, and one of the things that we found there is that Black people don't go to the forest preserves. They don't access those resources. And in doing a little bit of research behind it, we found out that that was true in other states too, including my own. And we live and breathe, we all live and breathe being outside. But it's such a huge part of who we are and our state's cultural identity that I was stunned to see that communities of color are far less likely to become involved. So you got to try harder. In a lot of ways to bring them in.
But Tanya, there's some, you sort of segued a comment I was going to make here. There's some very interesting, very recent research going on around, I know you mentioned race is that primary dimension of equity, so I'm going to talk about it, in that racial equity in stormwater management. There's a lot of great research just coming off the presses here. And specifically one I just read published this year that, you know, they talk about, as it is, stormwater management can often is a very technical space, but there is room for community involvement as we have here. And you mentioned getting the community involved, and there's some time series research that's come out, I think specifically with Charlotte, Mecklenburg County, area that more underserved groups, I'm using their language, more underserved groups were more willing actually to participate in stormwater remediation and the public process around that. But we just have to, I think what we're charged with, this is just the thought, is creating those spaces.
You do, and in a really intentional way. That's the key to this, is being strategic and intentional.
Tanya, you talked about listening centers. Can you expand on that a little bit? How do we get people to come to our meetings and participate if they don't know who we are?
Listening sessions, yeah. So what my advice would be to work with Clark County Public Works and have them start advertising in places. You know, you don't have to do big advertising. I'm not suggesting that you take out these, you know, massive print ads or buy commercial time, but make sure that you find opportunities to reach out to diverse populations in ways that you maybe hadn't thought of. For example, a really great way to meet with and recruit, if you will, encourage support from African American communities is to go to churches, particularly AME churches, and just talk with them. And then ask if maybe one of those churches, faith organizations, are actually really, really good community partners to have, because they're places where people go. I mean, you know, churches don't exist for one person. The whole idea is around a congregation. We've seen those work really well in things like restorative justice processes or community justice, but it is a good way to get in touch with communities of color. to look for things like that so that you can reach out, do advertising with them, ask if they'll partner with you. And then because we're living through COVID, we've done the overwhelming majority of our work virtually in meetings just like this, where we set up multiple numbers of meetings, so listening sessions, with there's not really any agenda, maybe a couple of questions to get conversation started, and then we just listen to what the community has to say about the concerns that they have. If you want to do that virtually, I'd say don't do more than about 35 people at a session, though. So schedule multiple sessions.
You know, the Washington Stormwater Center has done some specific work around environmental justice and stormwater management, and I'm wondering if they might be a resource for us. I don't know if that's an outreach issue or a partnership issue, so I don't want to overstep my bounds here, but I know they have a working group, and Eric might be the best person. Maybe Eric knows, has been involved in this, intricately knows about it, but I know they had some working groups put together to address some of the language that was around overburdened communities.
Yeah, and I think Eric would be a good place to, connect with whatever, group it ends up in. Traditionally, partnerships has been involved with the Southwest Stormwater group, but they've gone into a different mode since we had direct involvement, and more recently Eric has been sort of informing us of what's going on. I think there's some value in the direct connections, really. Mm-hmm. I don't care who in the commission does it, but there's value there.
Yeah, I'm also actually interested in learning more about what the Washington Stormwater Center has been doing. And I think I've been working more closely with the Clean Rivers Coalition in that Latinx focus group was also, they had a listening session there. So I'll see if it's on their website yet, that the report might be, and if it is, I'll be able to send you guys out a link for that.
I'm going to have to sign off, but I want to thank you, Tanya. This was really a very good presentation and great to hear DEI in a water context. So thank you for that. And I would like us to, at a future meeting, set aside some time to more think about implementing DEI B in the work that we do. Okay. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
If you like, I'll just make the rest of the October meeting be more of the DEI conversation and what we already have. Just have the mapping and then go from there.
That sounds great.
Any other questions?
Sue. I'm trying how to get out.
You have to stay and listen to my class.
That's right.
I may.
Tanya, I wanted to get your input on a question that comes to my mind often with these conversations. But you mentioned on the outset of the presentation about how the general focus becomes particularly race and gender because that's where a lot of the national dialogue is at. And so something I see happening a lot, particularly in a community like Clark County, where the demographic makeup sometimes puts people in a position when they approach issues of DEI, for lack of better eloquence to it, and looking like becoming a solution looking for a problem. And that when you talk about the range of different diversity in the community, one of the big elements of diversity that I do see in this community is the difference between rural and urban. And you see a very big political divide if you look at the southeastern or the southwestern corner of the county compared to the northeastern corner of the county. They're polar opposites politically. So you're looking at cultural, political, economic, and lifestyle difference. Those people often all look the same on the surface. And so I find that the diversity of our community often gets overlooked for this other element of diversity that's very central in the kind of national dialogue. And so I find in lots of situations I'm involved in with work and volunteer opportunities like this that the conversation inevitably slips back to the racial element, which is incredibly important, but there's also this other big element of diversity in our community that's been overlooked. I don't know how often you run into that and how you address that piece as well.
We run into it a lot, actually. We would consider political ideology to be a dimension of diversity, and an important dimension of diversity when it comes to public policy in particular. And you're right. It's easy to, you know, when you look at that iceberg, you know, what's above the waterline, but what's above the waterline is easy. Those are kind of the easy diversity targets because it's the stuff that we can see. But what drives our values and our decision-making and what's important to us as humans is very often below the waterline. Even when we look around a room and it looks like everybody is the same, we're not all the same. So we've worked with a number of clients where, and I'm thinking of one in Wisconsin where, I mean, there was just like you described, where there was this, you know, the southwest part of the county is very different politically from the northeast corner of the county. They had a highway that divided their county. People who lived west of the highway were super conservative. People who live east of the highway were much more inclined to be more liberal and democratic thinkers in terms of ideology. And trying to figure out how to bring those two things together was difficult. And it didn't happen overnight. And in fact, I think they're still working on it because you have to find the common ground between people. And when you're talking about things like public policy, we lose track. We're just so oriented in this win versus lose. You know, I'm gonna win. I'm going to beat you. My party is better than your party. No, my party is better than your party. And we're fighting constantly because we're looking to win. We want to like overcome somebody. But when you look in that common ground, when you find a way to identify the common ground, it's there. And then you start building from there. A good example of the common, you know, this is the way most people are thinking. It's the most dominant way, I think, that we're talking about race and culture and diversity in America right now has to do with law enforcement and police reform. And even when you look at those different dialogues that are happening between, for example, House Democrats and Senate Republicans, even they found common ground in the middle, and that's the basis of where they're looking at how to build and reimagine what policing looks like. And you can do the same thing by bringing the two sides together, make sure everybody checks their, you know, weapons at the door if you need to, but bring them together and start to figure out where that common ground lies. Sorry, I needed to take a drink there. I don't know if that was helpful to you, but a lot of it is dialogue.
I definitely appreciate it. I know that, it was just the comment I was making with regard to, you know, the focus, and you mentioned it in the beginning there, that, like, you know, expanding what you see as diversity for the objectives that you're trying to reach.
Yep, and
it's hard to think of diversity differently.
Tanya, if I could chime in and kind of answer for you, because I've seen you do this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's my observation of what I've seen you do, is that has been really helpful in polarized environments where you've done that. Sorry, I lost everybody's picture, but... Yeah, where you've come in and talked about, you know, race definitely is a primary dimension of diversity, but diversity is so much more beyond that.
It is, and part of being ready to deal, you know, to deal with, not that it is a challenge, but it's a worthwhile challenge. As you're preparing to consider ways to be more consciously inclusive, how's that? Also, mentally prepare yourself for the very real possibility that you'll be challenging your own biases, that you have to think about what drives my decision-making process. How do I think differently about this, and how comfortable can you be, and I think I said this, is, you know, taking your shoes off and putting somebody else's on. Not literally, don't do that literally, you know, COVID and everything, but metaphorically, thinking how do we, you know, how do I see the world through somebody else's eyes and experiences? And that is really, really, it's difficult work. It's hard work. It's sort of like you have to get really comfortable with the idea of being uncomfortable.
Yep. If we do have more public in attendance, you get more practice at that.
That's true.
That's really more of a that's more of a reference usually to council meetings if you attend those.
I've attended a few of them. They can be they're interesting.
go attend San Francisco's council meetings. That would be interesting.
Fair enough. Well, being respectful of everybody's time, does anybody else have any other questions? Tanya, I want to thank you a lot on behalf of the commission. Really appreciate it. Doing a late evening presentation for us as well.
You are so welcome. My pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, thanks, especially since your time is ahead of us. It's actually later where you're sitting.
Double
not that far ahead. Only an hour. We're good. Everyone, thank you so much. Be safe. Stay well. Have a great evening. And if you have business to do, I'm going to go ahead and log off in case you need to have a private conversation. But again, thank you for having me. I really, really enjoyed my time here.
Thank you. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
Have a good evening. I do not have my sheet up anymore, but I believe the only thing left now is to formally adjourn the meeting. So,
if there's any general discussion, but yeah.
All right. I will formally adjourn our meeting for the evening.
I will say one thing I did put in the chat, the Latinx research report from the Queen Rivers Coalition that came out in July, so you can grab that and check that out.
And I actually copied it, and I will put it in for, and Eric will probably be uploading it tomorrow onto the website, into the presentation and extra materials, so everybody can access it there. For the Clean Water Coalition Hispanic Latinx Community Research Report.
Excellent. Thank you, Eric, and thank you, Alice, for putting that up there. All right. Well, I'll see you guys all in October.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Have a good evening. Thank you, Alice.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Good night.